On Friday, October 18th of 2024, the Montana Wildlife Federation, National Parks Conservation Association, the Cinnabar Foundation, and the Gallatin Wildlife Association hosted a lecture in the Crawford Theater at the Emerson Cultural Center in Bozeman. The talk was titled The Future of Grizzlies and Wolves in Montana. It was moderated by Todd Wilkinson and featured two of America's leading wildlife experts, Dr. Chris Servine and Dr. Doug Smith.
Good evening. Welcome. We're so glad that you could be here with us. I'm Lori Riker, and I'm just going to provide a few remarks as we get started tonight. I'm the founder of Artemis Institute, which is a nonprofit whose mission focuses on the interrelationship between nature and humans through cultural programs and projects that help us explore how we can preserve and pass on wildness. And really the reason I'm here tonight to speak to you briefly is to tell you a quick story. So about 6 months ago, after several conversations with Bozeman journalist Todd Wilkinson and Gus O'Keefe about their vision for an online entity devoted to conservation journalism, Artemis Institute agreed to support Yellowstonian, as they now call it, as its key program through its nonprofit umbrella. Yellowstonian provides a voice for wildness, and it's available online for free. But of course, we rely on people like you to support us. So if you're not familiar with Yellowstonian and you want to check it out after the talk, it's easy. Just go to yellowstonian.org. And we're here today and thrilled for this event with all of you. We'd also like to talk about our other sponsors along with Yellowstonian. We have some well-respected co-sponsors, and they are Montana Wildlife Federation, the National Parks Conservation Association, Cinnabar Foundation, and the Gallatin Wildlife Federation. If we could give them a round of applause, please. Now, before we begin, I'd just like to take a quiet moment with you guys to respectfully acknowledge that we are here today in the homelands of these indigenous tribes, and we recognize their deep connection to this place that we call Montana, and that their cultures and combined living perspectives offer many insights for how we might better coexist with the natural world. If we could also show our respect and give them a round of applause. I hope you enjoy this evening, and now I'm going to turn it over to Todd.
It's really great that everybody came out tonight. One announcement I need to make is that there is a film crew making a documentary film, a pretty ambitious film on wolves, and I just wanted to let everyone know that they're here filming tonight. Quick question, a show of hands. How many of you have seen a wolf or a bear in Montana, Wyoming, or Idaho? Raise your hand. So think about this. If we were in 45 of the other states in the lower 48, no one in those states, maybe excepting Washington State, would be able to say that. Both species there. We're really at a historic moment here tonight where we've had this miracle of recovery. In the early 1980s, I was working in Yellowstone as a concession employee. And I remember public announcements relating to grizzly bears. And at that point, people thought that bears might wink out. A few years later, I came out here. I was a journalist. And I remember people saying that there was no way in Hades that we would ever see wolves here again. And so there are young people today who have grown up their whole lives never in the absence of wolves or bears in the Northern Rockies. And they don't realize this struggle and the fact that Chris and Doug are going to talk about this, that we've recovered them, but if we lose it, we're going to dewild for the last time. So before I make introductions to Chris and Doug, I want to mention that great bear footage was brought courtesy of Carrie Gunther, who's the lead grizzly bear biologist in Yellowstone. Let's give a hand to him. And that wolf, the howling, was given to us courtesy of Jeff Reed, who's with a company in Paradise Valley called Grizzly Systems, and it's called the Cry Wolf Project. And it's research in conjunction with wolf researchers in Yellowstone, and they're exploring bioacoustics, the languages of wolves. Four different packs. That's what you were listening to in terms of individual howls and chorus howls. Doug Smith was able to spend a quarter century in Yellowstone listening to that. But bioacoustics are really cool, and it's yet another contribution that the Yellowstone ecosystem is making. There's a story on bioacoustics at Yellowstonian, if you care to have a look. But let's give a round of applause to Jeff Reed. So Dr. Christopher Servine, he started as a young college student wanting to have a career in biology. He eventually did field work, and he was tapped to head federal grizzly bear recovery for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and he spent 35 years looking at the arc of grizzly bear recovery. Again, from those days when many thought we were going to lose the bear from the Yellowstone ecosystem. Chris is also considered an international expert on grizzly bears and bears throughout the world. The IUCN and other many respected institutions bring Chris in. He's advising. He thinks about rewilding bears in Europe and stuff, for example. Most recently, Chris serves as the volunteer board chair of the Montana Wildlife Federation. And tonight he's going to talk to us about how far we've come and where we are, and then we'll have a conversation about that. Doug Smith hails from Ohio, but spent time with the foremost wolf biologists in the world in the upper Midwest. Doug is best known for being the senior lead wolf biologist in Yellowstone National Park. He retired just a couple of years ago. Actively sought on the lecture circuit. Something else about Doug, he is an avian expert. He was in charge of looking after trumpeter swans and all kinds of species, double duty in Yellowstone National Park, and he's also one hell of an ecologist and a big picture thinker. So it's a pleasure to have you here tonight too, Doug. So without further ado, welcome to Dr. Christopher Servine.
Thanks, Todd. And it's a pleasure to be here tonight with all of you and with my buddy Doug. The two of us make a great act together, and I'm glad we can do this. We're going to do this again on Wednesday night in Missoula next week. And who knows, we may keep this up. So I'm going to talk to you about grizzly bears and the issues related to grizzly bears here. This is the range of grizzly bears used to go into central Mexico, all of the western lower 48 states and up into Canada. The red areas you see in that center map are the present range of the grizzly bears. Grizzly bears exist in about 4% of their historic habitat in the lower 48 states today. And this map over here, too many buttons. Here, this map is the range or the estimated range of grizzly bears in 1922. You can see island populations throughout much of the West there. And you can tell that, you know, all those populations, those islands have all disappeared except the small populations we have in this area where we are today. And 1922 is a key year because that's the last year there was a wild grizzly bear in the state of California, which had more grizzly bears than any other state upon the advent of Europeans here. And it's the only state to have a grizzly bear on the state flag. So they put grizzly bears on the state flag, and then they proceeded to kill every last one of them by 1922. Grizzly bears were listed under the Endangered Species Act in 1975, and recovery efforts began in 1981. But this is the places we thought grizzly bears were, all the blue areas, when they were listed in 1975. But since we started looking, we now know that the grizzly bears were gone from the Bitterroot ecosystem probably in the 1950s. And in the North Cascades, there were just one or two bears right along the U.S.-Canadian border, and functionally they're not there anymore today. So we really have grizzly bears in these four ecosystems that you see there on this map. So when we started the recovery program in 1981, there were probably 400 grizzly bears everywhere in the lower 48 states. And today there's over 2,000. And if you look at a place like the Yellowstone ecosystem, there were hardly any bears outside Yellowstone National Park. And in places like the Bob Marshall and the Scapegoat Wilderness up in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem up here, there were very few grizzly bears at all. And in fact, if you look at the historic records in Glacier National Park back in the 50s and the 60s, it was really rare for anybody to ever mention grizzly bears. I talked to guys that worked on the trail crews back then. They never saw a grizzly bear track anywhere. That's in Glacier Park. So we really got down to low numbers. And this map down here, all the red areas you can see on this map is the places that grizzly bears exist today in the lower 48 states. So you can see that they exist in many areas. Here are the recovery zones, the original recovery zones that you see in this map. So there's grizzly bears outside these recovery zones. And this population is about 60 miles from the Yellowstone population right now. And they will probably connect one of these days. And we can tell through DNA that these animals are moving across the landscape. So a couple of indicators of recovery. We have grizzly bears now denning on the prairie. And we've had grizzly bear females that have denned on the prairie and had cubs. And it's been over 100 years since bears denned on the prairie like this. And to give you an idea of where this place is, here's that den site you just looked at, and there's the mountains, Glacier Park, there in the distance, about 25 miles away. So this is what bears did before Lewis and Clark arrived. They denned out on the prairie like this and had young, and a few are starting to do that these days. Okay, landscape connectivity is really important to grizzly bears and their future. And this map, again, you saw that before, it shows that they are connecting. And what's happening is that those ecosystems, those four ecosystems that were still had grizzly bears when we started the process, are starting to be interconnected. And it's becoming one large interconnected metapopulation. So in the long term, the health of grizzly bears would greatly benefit by the connectivity between them and allowing them to move across the landscape this way. Rather than a series of four islands, a big connected population in the Northern Rockies would be much healthier. But there are increasing threats to grizzly bears today. Recovery is more than just numbers of grizzly bears. The Endangered Species Act requires that adequate regulatory mechanisms be in place so that when you delist a population, that grizzly bear deaths don't go up as soon as the ESA protections disappear. In the past few years, however, we've seen political backlash due to anti-predator hysteria in state legislatures in Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho. And this threatens the possibility of ever recovering and delisting grizzly bears. The focus of some agencies has changed from recovering grizzly bears to delisting grizzly bears, which is really unfortunate because for 30 years, while I was the recovery coordinator, everybody's emphasis was on recovering bears and helping them out. Delisting, which has taken them off the Endangered Species Act, takes the focus off real recovery and is pushed for political expediency, not for the benefit of grizzly bears. Delisting does not mean driving populations down to minimal numbers, as we're seeing right now happening with wolves in the three states. It does not mean reducing grizzly bear numbers in range immediately upon delisting. It does not mean minimum efforts to reduce conflicts outside recovery zones and help the people that live out there have fewer conflicts with bears. And it does not mean allowing new killing mechanisms on the landscape that will result in dead bears. So grizzly bears are still at risk today. A grave threat today is the state legislators and the governors who are passing legislation that implements harmful anti-carnivore policies and demonizes predators to justify those policies. Some of those policies are hound hunting of black bears where grizzly bears are present. Montana outlawed the hound hunting of black bears from 1921 until 2021, 100 years. And the 2021 legislature put it back in place. Wolf traps and snares with bait where grizzlies are present. And there you can see in these two pictures here, here's a grizzly with a wolf snare around his neck. Not much of a grizzly left, that's only his head. And here's a wolf trap on this bear is in a grizzly or a wolf trap. Paying people bounties to kill wolves, which is really unethical. Shooting wolves over bait at night with spotlights, it's not fair chase and it's unethical, and you don't know really what you're shooting in the dark when you're shooting something over bait. And the overall demonizing of predators to justify this unnecessary killing. All of this stuff has happened since 2020. Wolf trapping and neck snaring in grizzly range means more dead and injured grizzly bears, and many times we won't know about those dead bears. And this is a quote of Aldo Leopold, ethical behavior is doing the right thing when no one is watching, even when doing the wrong thing is legal. Hound hunters will kill grizzly bears, and encounters between people with hounds and grizzly bears is going to result in the death of grizzly bears and the injury of people. This is a newspaper article from British Columbia earlier this spring where a guy and his dad were hound hunting black bears and they ran into a grizzly bear. The individual was severely mauled and they killed the grizzly bear because of that interaction, all because of the use of hounds to hunt black bears in grizzly range. Montana and Idaho currently allow hound hunting of black bears where grizzly bears are present. That's only started since 2021. In 2024, Montana black bear hunting regulations again allow hound hunting of black bears where Fish, Wildlife, and Parks itself says grizzly bears may be present. So those white areas you see on that map are places where grizzly bears may be present. That's what that cross-hatching is. And those light-colored areas are open to hound hunting. This is being done while grizzly bears are still listed under the Endangered Species Act. One can only imagine what Montana hound hunting regulations would look like if grizzly bears were ever delisted. Why so anti-carnivore? This seems to be based on an abnormal hatred of carnivores that is not reasonable and is not based on facts. It is basically the anti-predator attitudes of the 1800s that have come back into the 2020s right now. These state policies toward carnivores have no place in modern-day fact-based wildlife management. If we are to maintain healthy wolf and grizzly populations in the future, we must manage them using science and facts, applied in a professional manner and refined through a balanced and fair public process. That is a direct quote from an article that Doug and I wrote for the Yellowstonian earlier this year. If you want to know more about this, you can read this article in the Yellowstonian. States like Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho should be proud of being some of the few places where grizzly bears and wolves remain in the lower 48 states. Only 4% of their former range has grizzly bears in it, and we're sitting in it today. Instead, some influential politicians in these states see grizzlies and wolves as a burden and an inconvenience. And that attitude is really negative toward bears and doesn't bode well for their future. It doesn't bode well for wolves either. The state should be proud to be some of the few places where these magnificent animals still roam in the wild. We should be very proud to live in this place and very proud that these animals are still here around us. We need to take care of them. They are a responsibility, not a burden. There are other threats to grizzly bears. Increasing recreation and land development also threatens grizzly bears. And you can see this graphic is showing the increase in the numbers of homes in Montana. A year at the top, and the dot, every dot is a home. I'm going to let this run for a moment to let this sink in. Montana is rapidly changing. The numbers of people living here and moving here are rapidly affecting the environment and the animals that try to live here. Todd, do you want to speak to that?
One of the focus areas of Yellowstonian is looking at this phenomenon called sprawl. You're going to be seeing a lot of investigative reports. But if you look at this and you think about the connectivity that Chris outlined, it's almost like the spread, those maps that we saw of the COVID pandemic or other things when you see a pandemic spread. And as Chris says, it's not hopeless of connectivity, but we have 20 counties in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and there's just one that has a countywide plan with planning, enforceable planning and zoning. And so where we live on the landscape is really important because we're displacing not only grizzly bears, but 230 other species that go with them. The real elephant in the room is private land sprawl. There's more habitat being lost to sprawl in Greater Yellowstone today by an order of magnitude than there is from oil and gas development, logging, and traditional resource extraction. 24 million acres in Greater Yellowstone, and one-fourth of it is private lands. So where we live on the landscape and how we approach it, we've got to be smarter about it or we're going to lose a lot of things.
Thanks, Todd. So Montana is not a static environment. There's a disconnect between human population growth, suburban sprawl, and the ability of wildlife to adapt to this ongoing development. Land development decisions should consider the impacts of such development on valuable animals like grizzly bears, and zoning and ways to consider development should be done. Look at those levels of growth since 2010 in those counties. Look at that level of growth in Gallatin County, 42.77%. That's not sustainable. If this continues, Bozeman is going to look like Salt Lake City. Suburban sprawl is the leading bleeding edge of bear management and bear survival as humans and bears expand into each other's habitat. This is happening in all those red dots that you see on that map. Bears move into places they've always been, and all of a sudden there's a new house there. People open their blinds in the morning in the spring, and they see a grizzly in their yard, and they call Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and they say, there's a bear in my yard, what do I do? And we want to tell them to move. But we can't, because nobody's ever tearing houses down. They're only building them. Recreation is also an issue. Agencies face increased demands for recreation, and they often ignore the impacts of all this recreation on wildlife. For example, human recreation drives bears off alpine moth feeding sites and thereby lowers caloric intake and could reduce grizzly bear fitness, reproductive output. Management of recreation in these important grizzly bear habitats is important to grizzly bear survival in the long run. And if we have to manage these kinds of things like hiking in these alpine areas where bears feed, and that is a grizzly bear right there, then that should be done. I'd like to note that the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes closed McDonald Peak, which is a main peak on their reservation where the bears come and feed on insects, and they've closed this now for more than 30 years. They were the first management entity to do this. So in summary, grizzly recovery is a success story, but it's now at risk due to politics and land use pressures. Bears have come a long way in 40 years. Why should we go backwards? Thank you for listening.
Okay, I guess I'll just start. There's a lot of people walking around up here. Thanks, Chris. I expected that to be a tough act to follow. I'll start by saying much of the history of wolves parallels the history of grizzly bears. They were eliminated from most of the continental United States, first on the East Coast, and then in the western United States by the 1930s. They were gone from Yellowstone by 1926, and really the only remaining population of wolves was in northeast Minnesota, and that was probably around 400 wolves. So the history of wolves parallels that of grizzly bears, and I would almost argue that wolf hatred was a level above other predator hatred, because a lot of the cattle industry came in behind the eradication of the bison. And so wolves losing their natural prey turned to preying on livestock. And this was one of the primary predators that had to go, was to get rid of the wolves. So this has been, the West has been largely unoccupied by wolves for most of the 20th century. And as Todd said, I grew up in Ohio, and how odd is it for an Ohio boy to become attracted to wolves? I grew up on a camp in Ohio and was attracted to nature, and so I was predisposed to being connected to nature. So my view about wolves is really, I'm ideologically predisposed to believe that wolves are symbols of the wild, pure and spiritual, and should be left alone whenever they can be. And their population should be allowed to increase, and they carry much symbolic value as to how the world should not be run and taken over by people. That, for me, was a philosophy that I attained early in life and matured into an older person thinking about. However, having studied wolves for 44 years, that philosophy won't work now. It is too radical. And it is very hard for me to say that, because that those are my personal beliefs. Wolves are hated. Wolves are considered a predator that are not wanted, as Chris so eloquently said. They're very different from a grizzly bear in terms of their biology, their sociality, and how their cultural baggage is approached. So here is one of the more, this is the frontispiece to Adolf Murray's monograph, The Wolves of Mount McKinley, now called Denali National Park. And really, this is the quintessential look of the wilds, yet wolves are reviled by most people, as Chris said. And this is a photo that I took in Yellowstone National Park with a wolf and a grizzly next to each other, and it signifies how rarely across the continental United States this kind of thing occurs. Even, you could argue, Canada. But what I would like to start by saying is these differences between grizzly bears and wolves are very important in terms of how we think about them and how we manage them. They are very different animals, and this impacts what we do. Bears are a solitary carnivore, living mostly by themselves or a female with cubs, and wolves are very, very social. They are a family living carnivore. They want to be in a pack. They have offspring every year. A lot of times their pack structures are very complex. So a very different social structure compared to grizzly bears. So here, social, highly productive. They breed every year, eat almost exclusively meat, and they can occur at very high densities. The northern range of Yellowstone is an excellent example. Bears are almost the antithesis of wolves. Solitary, do not breed every year, breed sporadically. Omnivorous, eat both vegetation and meat, but mostly vegetation, and they usually occur at low density. So what is our management response to these two different carnivores? Well, wolves are usually, wherever they occur across North America, killed at a high rate. Very liberal regulations, and the leading cause of mortality for wolves almost anywhere you go, lower 48, Canada, Alaska, is people. Bears, very limited harvest. Usually not killed. Wolves, you can remove up to 30% and maintain the population. Nothing like that for grizzly bears. If you make a mistake, you harvest too many, the argument is, just wait a few years and they bounce back right away. Highly fecund, highly productive. Grizzly bears, you make a mistake, you kill too many females, it could last for years. Killing wolves, it is considered necessary for human tolerance. In other words, for wolves to be on the landscape, a lot of people say you need to have a hunting season, you need to be quick to remove problem wolves, but killing wolves goes part and parcel of having them. Bears, there appears to be some commonality with that. That's the argument for delisting now. Wolves, because they can occur at high density, because they can sustain high harvest, we only need rough estimates of how many are out there. Bears, usually you need a very precise population estimate to know because of this management fragility that they have. So this leads to liberal regulations, and for bears, very restrictive regulations. This is where hunting and trapping occur. So a very different response to a social carnivore and a solitary carnivore, one with a high reproductive rate and a capability to bounce back, the other with a very low one. So these are kind of our responses to this different life history strategy. So what can we say about wolves? Mostly in Montana, again, population estimate 2023, notice approximately 1,100. This is not very precise because they're hard to count and expensive to count. So if management is forgiving, why have a good precise estimate? So this led to a harvest rate of about a little over 300 wolves. This is the wolves that were killed for livestock depredations. And this is roughly at that rate that I spoke about in the last slide, about 30% of the population. However, with this being a rough estimate, this cannot be precisely known. The hunting season lasts from mid-September to March 15th. I'll talk about this on another slide in a minute, but this is well before the pelts on wolves are prime or they can be used as a natural resource, which isn't going to occur for a wolf around late October or early November. Very long hunting season before their pelts are valuable. The trapping season, as I looked at the hunting regulations for Montana, hasn't been determined yet. Very few livestock killed. This was an issue for the reintroduction that we did in Yellowstone. This was going to be a problem. Very few killed in 2023. These are the latest statistics. And those killings were compensated for $43,000. This is against about 2.7 million cattle and sheep across Montana, 23 killed. The elk population, which was the second biggest issue, which is actually a harder issue because wolves are supposed to eat elk and deer, 143,000 is the estimate for 2023, which is higher than 1995. Harvest in 2023 is 30,000. 1995, it was 22,000. So the two biggest reasons to oppose wolves, livestock killing and competition with hunters, does not seem, as Chris said, to be an issue. So perplexing for some of our management responses towards wolves. Key issues facing wolf management, mostly in Montana, some Idaho. Is this going to be the legislature making decisions or trained wildlife biologists? Politics versus wildlife biology. Historically, wildlife decisions have been in the realm of the state game management agencies. And with carnivores, they're moving into the political legislative realm. Regulations. Chris touched on this. How are we able to kill them? Night hunting with spotlights, baiting, hunting outside the season when you would kill something as a natural resource, how many you can take per hunter, population estimates. This is the population count is determined by IPOM, that stands for Integrated Patch Occupancy Model, which is a modeling approach used to determine the distribution of a species. It is not does not work very well when you're trying to understand the abundance of a species. It can be adopted to that. They're conducting such modeling in Italy, for example, where they have a very rigorous approach, but it involves using capture-recapture modeling through scat sampling. This does not have that aspect to it, so it is, in a lot of people's minds, an inappropriate method to determine abundance. It does mostly determine distribution. So if you don't know, and if you only have an imprecise estimate to your population size, how can you determine what your offtake is? So I had 29% up there on the last slide. Well, how do you know if it's 29% if your actual estimate is very approximate or possibly inappropriate? And this goes back to the delisting. So wolves went back and forth with delisting and relisting, delisting again and then relisted, and they were finally delisted from the area in 2009. But the target population size listed in the final rule, and this is important, I was part of this, is probably too low. Each state is only required to have 100 wolves, and they're managing for 150, so 3 times 150 is 450 for the tri-state area. You saw the population size of 1,100 for Montana. It's greater for Idaho. It's actually less for Wyoming. So the actual management target the states have to achieve was determined low. And I think that was done because we set the bar low for wolves. They're socially difficult to live with. People don't want many wolves around. So the attitude was, what are we able to get? What will people accept? What is the social carrying capacity for wolves? Not what is a long-term sustainable population and what should we have? And so this is probably why the estimate is just rough, because why get a precise estimate when you're not required to have very many wolves? So this is a structural problem in the beginning, and I was involved with that process. I have, and it's created a long-term problem that will be hard to fix. So what some possible solutions are: having zonal management, having places where wolves are actually left alone if they're not causing problems, allowing their populations to achieve maybe a biological carrying capacity, certainly allowing their social structure to play out more fully, which a high harvest rate will not be allowed to do. And then there could be positive benefits for this. There does appear to be a correlation between where CWD occurrence is low and wolf density is higher. This is far from proven, and this is just in the preliminary stages, but there could be a selective advantage to having wolves cull for some of these diseases that we're going to get with these higher elk densities that I just showed you. So this is a graphic showing elk in 1995 in Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho. And in each case, the population size is larger now or a few years ago than it was when wolves were introduced, and in most cases, so is the harvest rate. So this was a huge reason to oppose wolves. Is they're going to do in my hunting, both elk and deer, and this has not been the case. Possibly because the population has been held lower, but certainly this is one of the biggest fears. This is what wolves are thought to do. So other problems with this is the North American model of wildlife management. These are the seven tenets that this policy is governed by. And this is the policy for most of the states in North America in terms of wildlife management. Wildlife is public trust, unlike Europe, which sometimes is owned privately, prohibition of commerce, rule of law, opportunity for all. I highlighted in red, killed for legitimate purpose, fair chase, no waste. This was this September 15th to March 15th hunting season. Why are you killing wolves when their pelts are prime? If you kill wolves as a natural resource, you shouldn't be killing them when they have no value. That's killing just for killing's sake. They're an international resource, and they should be managed based on the best available science, not this politically driven delist versus recovery. Both of these things are part of what our modern-day wildlife management is built on, and both are not aligned with this policy, this model. And specifically, this recently came up this last winter in Wyoming. It's an issue in Idaho and Montana as well. Hunting wolves and killing them via snow machines. The state legislatures have tried to get this, or some people in the state legislatures. Mike Phillips is a local Bozeman person who was a senator for 10 years, a legislator for 4, could not get a bill to prohibit killing foxes, coyotes, and wolves via vehicles, primarily snowmobiles, out of committee. And to my mind, what we should be working for are reasonable, moderate solutions that represent compromise that we can all agree on, and running animals down with snow machines, banning that, because this is an inhumane, unethical practice. And the fact that our representatives in all three states won't budge on that, to me, exemplifies some of the problems we're having with managing carnivores in this tri-state area. This should be easy. This should be banned, and it's been difficult. And so I think I think these attitudes is reflected in slides like this. This is deeply disturbing. I've looked at this photo for years, but this seems to be the attitude that is prevailing. So what I am hoping to get out of tonight, and what I'm hoping we can get to moving forward, is being able to move off of these extreme carnivore hatred policies that are enshrined in laws and regulations. So how do we do that? And in retirement, I have been reaching out to more people who regulate wildlife laws, and they appreciate reasonable, thoughtful, scientific, respectful intercourse. Not being yelled at, but hearing from people that truly care. Many of the commissioners are responsive to this kind of tactic. So what I would recommend to all of us tonight, rather than just kind of being another talk that we listen to, is we've got to move some of these wildlife policies from the extreme anti-carnivore position to some of the middle-of-the-road positions that people will listen to. That statement I read to you at the beginning, which is actually my personal philosophy, that's too far for us to reach now. We want to get there one day, and we got to get there by small steps. And here are some examples of small steps. By talking to the commissioners around Yellowstone National Park, These three hunt units were considered one previously, and now they've been split back to two. You used to be able to kill six wolves in this whole hunt unit, so you could almost wipe out an entire pack. This seems like a small victory, but those hunt units were split back into two different districts, so you can only kill three wolves in one and three wolves in the other. Very small win. The quotas used to be lower than six. They went up because we're losing some of these battles, so we're having to claw our way back in. But this geographically constrains harvest. The commission just passed this last August. Small victory. They also, believe it or not, it was legal to hunt wolves in the state of Montana with telemetry. So that was changed via the commission this last August. These are very small wins. These aren't big deals. But this was done by respectful dialogue with the commissioners. Your voice matters. Having them hear about moderate compromise wildlife management strategies to get off of these drastic policies that are in place. What are other things that we can do moving forward? Why doesn't Glacier have restricted quotas next to the park? Whacking is running them down with snowmobiles. That to me is a no-brainer. Night hunting, is that fair chase in the North American model of wildlife management on private land? Baiting? Chris eloquently talked about dogs. You can hunt wolves with dogs in Idaho. And then you can hire private hunters to hunt wolves in Idaho. And you can also get your costs to wolf hunting reimbursed, which is essentially a bounty. To me, all of these things should be important to all of us as easy wins, moderate compromise strategies where our voice should matter, because you're not being radical. You're not being an idealist. I want the whole state of Montana to be, no wolf hunting, no bear killing. It all should be a wilderness. No, these are middle of the road things that we're losing on that we need our voices to be heard on. And so what really do I want to get out of our session tonight? What do we want? Decisions based on data and science. That's not asking a lot. They're not now. We should all be asking for that. All voices included. Trust in all. It seems that picture of the guys in the white mask with the dead wolf, it seems that's winning out. We have an election coming up. Have your voice heard. All voices included. Grizzly bears, wolves don't have a voice. You can be that voice. Very important. You can speak for them. Why do you live in Montana? We have wolves and grizzly bears here. This is how we're treating them. And keeping Montana the last best place. That housing graphic, very worrisome to me. But why is it the last best place? Because it has grizzly bears and wolves and other carnivores. That's what makes it special. That's why we all live here. What are we doing? So here's an outfitter camp in Shoshone National Forest. We've got to talk to the other side because we've got to work these things out as decisions. This is what we want. This is why we live here. And if we lose these carnivores, it's not like that anymore. This is the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and these are all the roads. This is a map from Andy Hansen of Montana State. These are all the roads of any type, very similar to Chris's housing map. But look at this. This is considered one of the most intact temperate zone ecosystems in the world. Ah, I look at this, and I'm not so sure. The encroachments here. What do you think that's for wolves and grizzly bears? So we've got to be able to think of a way to compromise, because this all preservation, no use, conservation, sustained, wise use. We've got to figure a way to reconcile these kind of things so we can move forward. Compromise is key because we have brought back all these carnivores. They were gone. They were at low numbers. And now all of them have been restored to more biologically sustainable levels, but our management. And so we've won in a lot of ways. A lot of my colleagues have said, Doug, 50 years ago, you couldn't have imagined having wolves restored to Idaho, Montana, Wyoming. What are you worried about? I'm worried about our treatment and the way we look forward to management in the future. So your voices matter. This is my main point for my presentation. Thank you very much.
Those were Drs. Doug Smith and Chris Servine with moderator Todd Wilkinson in their lecture, The Future of Grizzlies and Wolves in Montana, held at the Emerson Cultural Center in Bozeman on Friday, October 18th of 2024. This is KGVM Bozeman, the audio mirror of the Gallatin Valley, 95.9 FM, kgvm.org online. We've got a Q&A session that followed the lecture at that event coming up next.